Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma-informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
Welcome to episode 37 of the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. I'm back here with Jerry and Kurt today to talk about the contagious nature of emotions, self-care, and organizational culture. And we're going to really build this as sort of a part two off episode 36 that we talked about last week when we talked about the power of social networks and how that impacts the folks that we work with, whether we're talking about behaviors, emotions, all sorts of things. So if you haven't listened to episode 36, I suggest you probably would want to go listen to that. But this was a topic that I thought was too important to pass up when we're talking about the power of social networks and the contagions of emotions. I'm sure we're going to have a great episode today. So because I've been severely ill this last week, I want to thank both Kurt and Jerry for their flexibility. We're actually recording this Memorial Day morning. And besides my thanks to them, I also want to send sort of our collective thanks for our bright, shiny objects of the weeks out today to military, their family members. And one of the great honors that I've had in the last about a year and a half, 2 years now, is to work with the Found Fort Carson School District. So I've done for the first time in my career, trainings on and working with schools on military bases. And one of the things that just really has struck out with me is, one, it's just a reminder that, you know, we were at talking before we hit record on this about the news. And you can go a whole day or two or three or sometimes a whole week and not hear about the wars we're in. And it really is just a reminder to me, even though I knew this was the reality, is that there's really families, communities still being impacted by the wars around the world that we're involved in. And just working with this district's not only a great respect for the service members that go over there, but also a lot of times, you know, somebody different comes back from those deployments, and how that, we've talked a lot about disruptions to the family system and how that can be traumatic for folks. And you know, just deployment, and I can't imagine as a young child having my parent go to war and wondering whether or not they would be alive at the end of the day. And, you know, maybe somebody coming back with post-traumatic stress disorders and other mental health issues that might be associated with their service. And then the whole infrastructure of teachers, support staff, therapists who work with these families as well. I mean, when you talk about real heroes, we throw the word hero around. LeBron James is a hero today because he beat the Celtics in game 7. But man, these folks are just, you know, embody that for me. So on Memorial Day, just want to give a shout out to not only those in the service, their families, but also all those that serve our veterans as well. And just want to maybe, Jerry, kick it to you first to add any words to that.
You know, the only thing I want to add is after watching my daughter give birth to a child this last week, really a shout out to the mothers of those service people. You know, really that, you know, the thought of giving birth to a child and then knowing they're going in harm's way not only impacts the immediate family, but really the parents of these, you know, brave individuals. So, you know, really looking at when we honor all the people that have given their lives for the freedoms for us to be able to do this podcast, in some ways, is just think about how many people surround those people that we kind of recognize today in as we celebrate this holiday.
Absolutely, congratulations, Grandpa! Is it now Four times over. Wow. Man, Christmas got to get expensive at some point there for you.
Yeah. That's what credit cards are for. Jerry. That's what credit cards are for.
Yeah, I think we all are a little jealous as we wish we had Jerry for our grandpa as well. you are perfectly set up for that role, my friend. So, yeah, that's Jerry, anything you want to add to this as well before we move on?
It reminds me of, I was in the military and never actually was deployed. And I actually went to graduate school, and my unit that I transferred from was deployed shortly after I left. So a lot of my very close friends were deployed. And it makes me think about this idea of the power of a social network, thinking of as close as I felt to those guys that I went through basically the stress of training with, and they went through the stress of it's not training anymore. And just imagining, I missed out on that, on that experience in some ways, that the closeness that they have felt to each other is really incredible. Mm-hmm. That they were with each other in situations where they really needed to depend on each other for survival. And that created some really incredibly close relationships that have lasted for, a long time. That's coming up on 20 years ago. And it's really incredible to see. I have lots of friends who've served in the military, and they all say the same thing about what it was like to have gone through experiences when they really had to depend on one another. And it really is incredible, the bonds that are made in those situations.
Very cool. And thanks for your service too, my friend, on this Memorial Day. So let's jump into the topic here. Again, I just want to summarize really quickly the research we talked about last week, just to set this up again as a refresher for those that might have listened even to episode 36. Last week we talked about a lot of research on social networks and how when we're exposed to certain behaviors or emotions, that those become our behaviors and emotions more often than not. So if we hang around a lot of people, one of the examples I like to use, because I living it, moving from the Midwest to here, is all these bicycling enthusiasts in Colorado who have the skin tight, biking outfits and go on these like 100-mile bike rides on the weekend. If all of a sudden you move out to someplace like Colorado, your chance of doing that activity just raises dramatically. If a lot of the people in your peer group do things like smoking or healthy eating or maybe have some depression, you're more likely to take on those characteristics as well. So we talked about really how when we're exposed to this and when we look at the people we serve who are trying to make behavioral changes or improve their mental health, but yet they're surrounded by people who have these behaviors, why that's a critical thing to address and one of the more difficult things to address as part of the change process. Today, I wanna think about us, and I wanna think about organizations, again, whether it's a school, a clinic, a residential facility, whatever it might be, and think about what happens to us. When we're, for a lot of us, we spend the majority of our day exposed to a high level of harmful behaviors and mental illness. And if we look at the data, and I've searched for it and I've never found it specifically about how does that fit into the research on social networks. I've never found that research. And if anybody listening has it, please send it my way. I would love to see it. But there's got to be a real impact to that. If you're spending, let's say, 6 hours a day with some of those negative emotions, somebody working with addiction, mental illness, even schools that are dealing with high levels of poverty or other things, that has to impact us as well. And I just kind of want to, as we start out this exploration, Kurt, maybe throw it to you first. Just kind of what, when you look at our self-care from this social network perspective, how does this sort of inform your role as thinking about leadership, management, and what's some challenges this might put forth to maintaining healthy teams and organizations?
I'll put a little bit of a spotlight on Jerry for my answer to this question. So I have a happen to have the knowledge that after we get done recording today, Jerry's going golfing. For any of you who know Jerry, golf is one of his true loves in life and hates as well, simultaneously. But, you know, when I logged on this morning, right, I look at Jerry's face. And if you're watching the video, right, Jerry's wearing a little Nike hat, obviously ready to go golfing. And there's a look on Jerry's face that I know Jerry pretty well. So I'm pretty attuned to facial cues that Jerry may change from time to time that give me cues about what his mood is or what his affective state is. So when I watch Jerry dressed in a different way and with this kind of facial cue, and I'm probably interpreting some of that myself, right? Because I know he's going golfing, right? He just looks pleased. He looks content. He looks excited. He looks happy to go. That has an impact on me. So I take these cues from another person and they actually can change my internal state. And when we think about how that works, I think of the model, the triune brain model, right? That the primitive brain can impact the emotional brain and the emotional parts of the brain impact the cortical parts of the brain. And all of those things can go up and impact each other going down. So as we think about the information that we're gathering from other people, and we as a social species are pretty attuned to looking at cues from other people to give us a sense of what's going on inside the skin of that other person that helps us to guide how we interact with that person, right? So if, you know, the opposite were true, right? If I log in this morning and Jerry's facial expression is sunken and he's not smiling and he's not wearing a hat and, you know, he's obviously stayed up all night, right? I'm going to be like, dude, what's wrong? Are you okay? And that's going to have a different impact on me. So these cues that we look at from others, we're really pretty attuned to those things and we're pretty sensitive to those things. What I found certainly really fascinating in treating a lot of children who came from congregate settings, a lot in Eastern Bloc countries and had come to the United States, been adopted, and they really came to be incredibly hypersensitive to the cues from others. And so they had this way that they had learned that if they were not hypersensitive to any kind of little changes in cues from other people that might give them a clue about what their state was and what their subsequent behavior would be, that they did not feel safe if they weren't hypervigilant to those things. So they would live in this kind of state of hypervigilance. When we put that into teams and how teams function, that all kind of comes into play as well, right? When we're in groups and we're talking about problems that we need to solve or experiences that we've gone through, how we describe them and the cues that we give to others in our environment certainly has an effect on how that person views that event and how that person has an affective reaction to the description of that event and to the cues that happen in that setting. So those things become really important when we think about how teams function, how congregate settings work, and how even individual interactions work, and that we take a lot of cues from others. And certainly we then, on the other side of it, there's also kind of the reinforcement side of that equation, or the reward and consequence side of that equation, that when we essentially behave in a way that is expected by another person, they tend to reciprocate to us in a certain way. And so we have this kind of feedback loop that happens, and that the cue, and you know, starts us moving in a certain direction, or it may change our affective state, it may change our interpretation of things, it may change how we act around a certain person, and then that person or that environmental feedback to us keeps that going in a way that can become either, if it goes in the right direction, it's great. And if it goes in the wrong direction, it can go that way very, very quickly. So that's kind of what I was thinking while you were talking about that, and certainly to, you know, looking at how it was really enjoyable for me to see this big smile on Jerry's face this morning when I said, "You going golfing after this?" And, you know, you see this great big smile and just look of excitement on Jerry's face.
All right, Tiger Woods, what are your thoughts on this, my friend?
You know, this is an interesting topic, right? Because we heal in the context of relationships, but we're also hurt in the context of relationships. So when we're an organization really is a makeup of multiple levels of relationships. So when I think an important piece, Matt, that you raise is that we're exposed to a great deal of suffering, that this organization came together to work with individuals who are suffering. But a key variable in that is this sense of control. Is in one situation where we are, feel out of control, things are happening to us and we're in a state of constant danger or actual life threat. And in another one, we're actually theoretically in control and carrying out a mission. As we talk about people going to war and people, is that there's some type of shared mission that is driving us to do this work. And there is research on the power of a sense of control. So the higher up you are in an organization, the more sense of control you feel, that actually the less the stress impacts you, right? So in some ways, given that we know that, is how do we develop a leadership model that allows people who are directly in contact with the clients to have feel a sense of control, right? As opposed to being out of control in the organization. So you develop strategies to allow them to share, have a shared responsibility for this mission, to engage in shared problem solving and leadership, to be able to feel responsibility to manage their own emotional states, to kind of look at that, you know, developing healthy lines of communication, to kind of be looking at those, and to really, in some ways, help them feel like they're, help them to be in a reflective state as opposed to a reactive state.
Yeah.
When we're in a reflective state, we feel in control of things. Mm-hmm. We're using the model of the triune brain. We want to get in that top part of our brain that allows us to problem solve, to think, to set goals, to have a sense of future. All of those as opposed to being kind of reactive, on automatic behaviors, really scanning the environment for threat and danger. All of those is when we're in those states, we feel out of control of things. So when we are looking at the transition from providing care to clients, we really want to take those same models that we've developed to say what creates healthy individuals and then apply it to our leadership models for organizations.
Yeah. And that's, you know, one of the things that, that I found fascinating as I started, and Jerry kind of shared this experience with me when we worked together in a child welfare residential facility is, I started to learn about this, and I remember we would send some staff away to another organization to get, I think I can say Kemp Center, because the trainings that they've always done, I've always thought incredibly highly of, and some of my staff would start coming back before I went and got more trained on this and said, you know, wow, this stuff's amazing, and a lot of us are acting like we're traumatized as well. And I thought that was sort of a different twist of what I was starting to see just through my observations is that, you know, I was thinking about this a little different way, is that a lot of the clients that we seem to work with, again, this was before I got the trauma-informed lens that I could put on this, that I was using the language is that, boy, a lot of our clients are acting burned out because I had that language at the time. Then we had the language of vicarious and secondary trauma, which I don't, those are podcasts sort of in their own, but to sum them up, you know, in a real rough way, is we know that trauma is also contagious, that we can experience the symptoms of PTSD with the only identifiable trauma being the work that we do in our exposure to other people's traumatic work. So all of a sudden I saw this sort of, we started to get a language around this. And, you know, as someone who's probably introduced the concepts of vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, and really a deeper dive into burnout to tens of thousands of people at this point around the country with my self-care trainings, you know, one of the things that I really have come to really look at and appreciate is not just that trauma is contagious and stress is contagious, but I use a pretty simple model of burnout where the first stage is exhaustion, second stage is shame and guilt, third stage is cynicism and callousness, and the fourth stage is crisis. And, you know, it's not only sort of just the trauma or the burnout that's contagious, but boy, you see so much of the shame and guilt and cynicism really take hold. And one of the things that Jerry introduced me to that I really, probably because Jerry introduced it to me, but something that really stuck with me throughout the years, and I sometimes still curse him to this day, for having introduced the concept of parallel processes to me. And my understanding of parallel processes is that dysfunction in one part of the organization will often be replicated in other parts of the organization or system. And so when we think about this contagious nature of stress, we've got some really nice language, whether it's vicarious trauma, secondary trauma, parallel processes, burnout, to really say, you know, not only is this impacting the folks we work with, not only is it impacting the direct care folks, but also impacting leaderships as well. And I think probably all three of us have seen, and I just want to take a moment to get your guys' thoughts on this, is how that nature that emotions are contagious can really overwhelm organizations. And I've also seen it overwhelm entire systems as well. And I think I just want to like take a step back a little bit and say, you know, just throw it out to you, is I've seen this as such a powerful thing, and more just probably one of the number one, if not the number one, destroyers of our ability to give quality services to those we want to give. If you were to say, hey, Matt, what do you think is the one thing we could do across the country and all these industries you work with to improve quality? My number one answer at this point is self-care, because I see the other side of that when we don't. And I just would love to get your guys' thoughts about, you know, am I overreacting to this like destruction that I see? Because you know me, I'm way over dramatic about most things. But just kind of want to, you know, level me out here. What do you guys see with your travels, your work? Because I know we all go different organizations and systems.
I think the answer to are you overreacting is almost always yes, Matt.
Yeah, okay. Maybe that's my own assumption as well.
But you're not wrong, right? I mean, I think you're, if you had to pick one thing, that's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good one to pick. It's a hard one to do.
Yeah.
And I think that it's so difficult to do because that there are always limited resources, and how we allocate resources is just so difficult. Those are hard decisions to make, and you're dealing with a field, and I don't think this is necessarily unique to just the field of treating people who've been traumatized or even the mental health field. I think this is true in other places as well, but we're really dealing with a kind of a substrate of daily problems and daily issues that need to be solved, that there are too many to be solved on any given day. And so there's always more need than the system or an organization or an individual has the capacity to probably provide in a finite period of time. It's always it's a marathon. It is not a sprint, right? And one of the things that I've said over the years to people in thinking about this is, when you think about, start at the people who have kind of the least amount or the the least control over what happens in an organization is often the patients who come to get care, right? They almost have the least amount of control. In other ways, they have the most because they can just go somewhere else, right? They can choose to go another place.
Sometimes.
Yeah, fair point. But nobody comes for services to a organization that serves people with really severe trauma-related disorders. Nobody comes because things are going well. Everybody comes because there's a problem and that there is a symptom that is generating them coming. And so it's like that is just a constant substrate that exists for the front line of people. Like they're always, they're engaging with every person on the first time they ever engage with that new person. It is around some negative affect, something that's generating some pain. And so they have to deal with that with thousands of repetitions, like it's over and over and over again. And when they get overwhelmed, then they pass it to their supervisor. And so, and then every supervisor's interaction with everybody that they're supervising becomes, I'm overwhelmed, and now let me pass that on to you. Mm-hmm. And then to their supervisor and to their supervisor. And so seeing how that plays from really that kind of the bottom layer of an organization all the way to the top layer of an organizational hierarchy is that negative affect and feelings of being overwhelmed and not being able to solve problems get past every level up the organization. Mm-hmm. A critical point also is to understand that that's happening all the time, right? It's happening all the time. And how you react to that, right? When you get overwhelmed, how you react to the person either parallel with you or below you in the organization is that if you pass it back down in a way that is retaliatory or microaggressions are big here, those become ripples that go all the way down the organization. So that's kind of one of the, I think that's one of the hard parts about it is that it's just that way every day.
Yeah, it's just kind and of, I think, and I've said this for years, really, this was my first introduction and Jerry got a lot of these initial ideas is that's a different type of leadership than you find in most business books that you pick up on leadership, of having to deal with those ripples that are often walking through our door each and every day. And just like you said, the constant stress and working with different folks is we don't know. Yeah, they're bringing in their trauma and their pain, but did they bring in a knife at the same time? There's all those different questions that I think you put in a really nice focus for us there. And Jerry, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. I think Kurt really with those ripples talks about the concept of parallel processes and a good way to look at it as well.
As Kurt was talking, you think about not just your organization, but culturally how we see things, right? And so you think about, say, for example, we'll take child abuse. So Dr. Henry Kemp in 1962 delivers a paper that kind of opens the eyes to our society that children are actually being physically hurt by their parents, right? And that was not necessarily received very well at first, and then people were shocked because in some ways everybody was hurting their children. Everybody was spanking them and everybody was hurting them, and that really we didn't want to be thinking about parents who hurt their kids. So people were coming into the, children were coming into the hospital with undescribed or mysterious kind of injuries that were not really addressed. And then through this research at the Kemp Center, which really was just the beginning of that, they identified these battered child syndrome. Well, then in a reaction to that, we create a child protection system that goes to kind of respond immediately to our crisis of that parents were hurting their children. So now we had a system that saw parents as the symptom and bad, and we created a whole system to kind of respond to that, right? And then we created all these organizations that were gonna take these children when we kind of took the parents away from their kids to take care of the children, because we were kind of, right? And our models at the time were that parents were bad and we had to kind of protect these children. Well, over years, we have a very different understanding of really the cause, right? That in some ways, what we understand now is trauma and stress result in parents who can't manage their internal state and act out and cause pain, right? And so we have it, or we see the same thing as we see people who are homeless. We create organizations to get them services. So we have this whole structure of organizations that were designed to treat the symptoms as we defined them previously. Not, we didn't go back and say, oh, now we have a new model. Let's really restructure the whole system and say, let's do this again, come up, right? And so you have, in some ways, in these systems, years and years of habits of how they see and organize to take care of the models that come through. As a society, we didn't go back and saying stress and poverty and homelessness is really creating and driving all this, and look at all the money we're spending to create this. Why don't we just make sure that people have food and make sure people have housing and make sure that parents are well supported and make sure that we created organizations. Right? And so when we sit here today to talk about these organizations, there's lots of events that these organizations respond to, but they never really go down and underlook at what are the real structures. And in the term the literature talks about artifacts, old artifacts that we created that represent this old model. How are we still running our organizations based on the old, and how could we change now to be able to integrate this new knowledge and information, and what would our organization look like? And I think that's that new leadership model. Mm-hmm. That's seeing that really kids in distress and challenging are kids who have attachment issues, kids who have stress regulation issues, kids who have physiological regulation issues, right? Parents who are in that are overwhelmed and can't provide what they're in a defensive state, so they can't provide the pattern repetitive open experiences for their children that their children's brains need to grow and to kind of look at that, right? So if we take all this knowledge, we would reorganize our organizations, which is what in some ways I try to do as saying is, you know, I worked at the Denver Children's Home at the time, and I went back to our mission and said, our mission really said, we're going to create a safe place for children to heal and grow. And I challenged us to say, what does that really mean today as opposed to what it meant before? So I began to bring in music therapy and yoga and health and kind of looking at recreation and kind of, right? And so my model of, I had a really challenge, and then the system kicked back at me and said, you know, why are you reinforcing these bad behaviors by giving these kids up, right? So I had a really struggle, but as a leader, that vision of saying we need not to function as the organization was created, but as we envision it to be.
Yeah.
So I think that's really where this knowledge of how our social environment organizes us can do it, is that we really have to change the system of providing to people who are injured and see them as injured as opposed to see them as sick or bad, or right, as we initially built these systems on.
Yeah, and I think just the challenge of that, I think when you think about parallel processes, I think you gave really good voice to something I see is, You know, and it's interesting how this paradigm takes hold in different places, different systems. Is sometimes the system above you that gives you money to stay in business and keep your doors open is not flexible. So you're trying to create that system and you're not funded in a way to give that flexibility. So there's these parallel processes really that can impact us on all kinds of different levels. I want to sort of, with the rest of the time we have, first look at some of the best practices or just ideas we have about understanding this, because I think the understanding piece is such a critical part of this, is that even though, again, I don't have the study, if anybody out there is sitting on $100,000 of research money, I'm sure the three of us would love to help you do a study on social networks with helping professionals. But assuming that exposure, and I think we have enough data to say that there is evidence out there to support this, that exposure to stress and trauma of our students, patients, clients that we're serving is in our social network and does have that impact on us. Maybe some things we can do first internally within organizations structurally to ensure that these aren't having a negative consequence on us. So any just, again, with limited time, Kurt, any just kind of concrete strategies, how do we use the social networks for good? Because again, the positive behaviors are also contagious as well. So just any thoughts you have structurally from a leadership perspective, from a staff perspective, some concrete stuff we might focus on.
Well, I'll give you a kind of a concrete example and go to the abstract real quick.
Hey, if I tried to get concrete, you can go wherever you want. So, this is more self-regulating for myself than anything else.
In a related way. So I'll tell you a story of a couple of managers that I knew years ago who we were talking about training, right? And we were talking about how, you know, a lot of times in these residential centers and in classrooms and in the organizations and environments where we work, they go through cycles, and they go through cycles based on the people who are in those environments and their stress levels and their training levels, their knowledge levels, right? And so I was talking to these managers about, they had some data points that were showing that a couple of these classrooms were really having lots of problems really managing the behavior of the kids in the classroom. They're having a hard time making sure that everything was okay, right? We had lots and lots of events that were dangerous happening, right? So you got to respond to that. And so we were having this discussion about what we thought the causes were in this change, that things had been going well and now they weren't going so well. And one of the things that these managers talked about was training. And they said, well, we're not in a position where we have a group of people who are trained to be able to do what they need to do. So we need to get them to this point. And they started talking about this kind of magical point where training was done. And when we kept talking about it more, we started talking a little bit and shifting our conversation to be towards that there never is that point. That you're working for a point that doesn't exist really. And so rather than thinking of training being something that you do in order to fix a problem, when a problem has already occurred, that training is something that you do 365 days a year, like you just do it over and over and over and over again and not wait for this point to get to. And I think that kind of way of approaching this problem of how do we combat and counteract the effects of constant negative affect being a part of the organizations that we're in, as a function of the work that we do, is not to think of it as, well, when this one person leaves, or well, when we get this training done, or well, when we get that done. It's not this kind of leaping from one point to another. It really is that we do the things to combat the aspect that we're going to have this constant level of pain and negative affect and emotion that we have to deal with every single day. And so building that into what we do every single day as a part of our organizational practices is just a little shift in the way of thinking about it that I think is an important shift given the experiences I've had over the last 20 years or so in how people think about that problem.
Right.
Tend to kind of be in the position that I was in talking to these two managers, right? You got called in there because there was some data that you got to respond to, right?
Yeah.
And then thinking about it as, you know, what is this manager going to do to solve this problem today was really something that wasn't really useful for me to do with them. Mm-hmm. But it was more talking about what do we need to do in terms of practices that our organization does.
Yeah.
As a part of every single day was a different way of viewing it.
Very cool. Jerry, anything to add? Things we can do internally to help, you know, again, utilize this research for good.
So I think we need to take all the episodes we have up to this point and say, how do we apply this stuff to our organizations, right? And so what it starts with is a mindful leader, a leader who can in some ways integrate what they're sensing, what they're feeling, along with goals and objectives that they're trying to be really aware of their own history, aware of what are their triggers, what are their reactivity, and to be way more mindful as you think about you are the ultimate co-regulator of this organization, right? To kind of look at that. And then when you work on yourself to go into meetings, then you think about, now how can I increase the capacity for my staff to be mindful of what's going on, to be in a state of creativity, to be in a state of innovation, to be in a state of finding really incredibly new solutions to old complex problems. How do I create that as a leader for the staff that are around me, right? So that I'm constantly trying to make sure that my staff is having a voice in what they're said, that I'm creating a space where people's voices are heard, they're seen, they're known. I'm forming a connectedness to my staff. I'm seeing them as our, you know, instead of they're really good or they're bad, is like, what's their arousal state? How are they in a place to do it? And so once I do that with my staff, now we have to say is, how do we do that with our organization? Right? So this parallel process, you know, and Kurt knows, we talk about it all the time, is instead of me as a leader throwing big rocks in the pond to create negative states, I use this knowledge to intentionally throw different kinds of rocks in the pond to create positive states. And I believe that as a leader, because of that model, I use a systems thinking. Right? Very different than event thinking, is that how I bring myself and then how my staff brings themselves has a ripple effect down through the organization. So, you know, you can look at models that like Sandra Bloom's sanctuary models, or you could look at the literature that talking a lot about today about mindful leaders. It all is based on, in some ways, people being able to move, in Daniel Siegel's line, to a more integrated state that allows us to create the social environment that increases the possibility for healing and recovery for our clients.
Yeah, and I just like to add yes and yes and yes to all that, and just a few more, I think, to piggyback on what both of you said too. Really important, I would say, especially at the leadership level, because that's sort of the model, as Jerry, you're talking about the individual leader. I'd like to talk about more of a team, sort of the leadership team is, if you know, and I've gotten kicked out of a few organizations and lost some potential work over the years, because one of my first questions, sometimes as a self-care trainer, I'm asked to come in and something's wrong with my staff, can you come in and fix them? Well, my first question now has been, tell me about the relationships at the leadership level. And usually what I find out is I'm asked to leave, sometimes politely, sometimes impolitely. Because if there's dysfunction at the top of the organization between individuals, then that's going to manifest itself all throughout the organization. So there's a real sense, I believe, with the social network literature and the parallel processes, that if there is dysfunctions within teams, we've got to address that in healthy ways. Just like if there's disruptions in the relationships we have with patients or clients or students, that repairing that's a very healing thing, allowing that to manifest and fester into resentment is not healthy. I'm also a little bit like, there's things that over time that you kind of look for to assess things. Level of gossip can often be a good indicator of you've got things going on. And when I hear the statement, I don't like her, but I can work with her. I think maybe if you work at a bank, that's okay. I think the level of support we need in our teams, that doesn't work in our organizations. Why don't you like this person? Would be my question. And so just making sure if we see dysfunctions that we really do it. The other thing is that I really encourage people to do is make sure you introduce some positive aspects into your meetings as well. A lot of times we'll jump right to the biggest problem right off the bat. Having people talk about like just little openers to meetings, like something good that's happened, or tell me about one of the things I really like, because there's research behind this, is having somebody talk about why they're doing this work, what's their passion for this work, why they enter this field. Just those little like 4 or 5 minute activities at the beginning to put everybody in a positive state before you hit some of the harder issues as well. And then I think I mentioned this a couple episodes ago, that powerful thing at the end of the day or the end of the meeting saying, here's 3 positive things that happened in my day, and sending that out to your team. Again, weird research that shows that that's an incredible, powerful tool as well. So, you know, really, if there is disruption there, really addressing that, but also thinking about how do we bring that positive energy strategically into what we do as well. So those would just be the things I'd add on top of what you all said. With our last few minutes, I just sort of want to step outside the organization, say for our listeners, what do you think, if you guys have any thoughts about some things they can do with their own self-care? Obviously, inside the organization is important, but their own self-care to utilize social networks to make sure they maintain or recover their health if they do hit those levels of burnout. Heard anything on this that you can think of?
Well, when you said what you can do personally, I mean, I think of I thought a lot more individually than social networks. certainly, I think mindful meditation is a great tool to be able to use. For me personally, deep breathing is one that is just incredibly helpful. That's something that I can do when I'm in a meeting and I'm feeling myself get stressed and get a little activated. That's an easy one for me to be able to do. So those are some things that I think of. Immediately think about social networks. A big part of being a really positive member of a social network is just being regulated yourself. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about that, I think, is really important. And that certainly tends to let people gravitate towards you. You know, I think I've found that when I'm kind of at my best and in a really regulated state, I tend to have a much wider social network than otherwise. So yeah. That's what popped into my head immediately.
Great. Jerry, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think I have a lot to add, but I won't. It'll take another whole episode to add on self-care to kind of look at. But I think in terms of the conversation today, you mentioned this why of knowing why we're doing that. And I, you know, if you look at the attachment literature, when they look at adult attachment, there's not a high correlation between just having what does it take to be a parent who could create a secure relationship in your child and the quality of your life experiences up to that. There's lots of individuals who've had really bad adversity to overcome, but they seem to be able to create a secure attachment in their children. And what allows that is the internal narrative, the explanation they begin to tell themselves about what happened in their lives, right? Is that when we have a narrative that can make sense of the experiences, could put it in, and then allows us, so a parent could say, you know, I had parents who were overwhelmed, who were struggling, and I want to do something different in my life to kind of, when we could create a different narrative in our minds, it drives us to be able to have different outcomes. And so I've always thought, well, if that works for the individual in creating a secure relationship, how does having a personal mission allow us to have a narrative in our mind as opposed to, oh, I had a good session today, or my client showed up today is driving it. Am I carrying out my personal mission? Am I really in life having a purpose and fulfilling that purpose? So I think for self-care is spending some time, not coming in work, in some ways just being blown by the wind, whatever direction it's going that day, but really having a vision of what is your vision of a brighter future that you are part of creating by the work that you do. Right. And I think that is a protective factor that allows us, even though we're dealing with adversity, to create secure connections with the people we work with and the people that are our coworkers, and to be able to work in what you said is maybe a rigid system that is not necessarily trauma-informed, but we have an individual mission that allows us to kind of survive and kind of prosper in those kind of missions. So that's my advice to people.
Absolutely, and there's been some really great research on that too, is that people that continue to live that purpose actually age much better and live much longer too. So having a purpose, and really, I think we all have that. If you're listening to this podcast, you have that, but reminding ourselves we have it is also very important too. The few things I've seen in the research I want to add to that too is just the importance of our personal social networks. There's a lot of research out there that the more time we spend around healthy, happy people that bring joy into our life, the healthier and happier we are as well. So just, working with people in poverty and experiencing homelessness, I've really come to appreciate how lucky I am as an individual to have enough resources in my life where I have friends that I can just go hang out with them. There's nothing I need from them. There's nothing that, hey, I've got to get this done through this person. I can just go have fun with them. I can go play a game with them. I can go hang out and have dinner with them. And sometimes what we see when we get more burned out, we become more isolated. And that's actually the worst thing we can do for our health. So really trying to make sure that we surround ourselves with healthy, happy people, because that emotion will be contagious for us. Another really concrete thing, and I see this and I challenge my audiences when I talk about this, is we can't stigmatize our own mental health therapy as well. This work, I say, and I try to live this example, if you're going to do this for a career, probably at some point, if you're like me multiple times, you're going to need your own therapy as well. This will trigger anything that you have. So bringing a therapist into your social network in a professional way, to me, builds resiliency and strength. And most of the people that I see that are still healthy with this, that are, you know, my role models now that I'm in my 40s, because I want to be healthy doing this for another 20 plus 30 years, have utilized that as well. The final thing with the social networks, as Jerry said, with the mission, I think is really important. But really, also from a professional standpoint too, is the other cool piece of research is that people with strong social professional networks have actually higher IQs. And the reason, and I've done this, and this podcast is a great example of this.
I don't know if they had us in the...
I had somebody tell me, my good friend, one of my good friends down in Colorado Springs, is like, You know, it's funny to watch you, like, you're the least smart person on the podcast. And I'm like, I know, but I get to learn the most. And this to me is an example with
both the silver lining of low IQ. You have the
I
most
am
learned.
So much smarter because of both of you. And I'm sure you get what I'm doing, but as I send my annoying questions out to you guys and poke you and see what I can get out of you, I get smarter because of that. I'm who I am today because it wasn't like Jerry just threw the ACE study at me and I took off from there. I've asked Jerry probably millions of questions. And then, of course, Jerry asked me, well, the real question is after
really,
that.
The question. But,
you know, so those I call them professional friendships. And sometimes, you know, we can hang out as just friends. Sometimes we hang out more as professionals. But, you know, there's some really cool research that says we're actually smarter when we build those networks and we utilize those as well. So that's just another fun piece of nerd research too.
There's something, you know, Jerry, that what you alluded to as an important protective factor that I think is important to kind of to say a little bit more about, and this is how I understand, and you can correct me, you know, if I've misunderstood, but one of the things that I heard in what you said is to really help people to be attached to and rewarded by both process and by outcome. And, you know, maybe even a little more by process than by outcome, because outcomes are, you never know when they're going to come, oftentimes in the applied world. But, you know, knowing what your process is and being rewarded by the process, I think is an important part of establishing how we have some health within our teams and within our organizations that we can do that for each other.
Sure. That's exactly right. You know, a good example of this social is, I don't think I would have done a podcast if it wasn't for you guys, man. So the fact that we're here is a good example of, if you hang out with people who are going to do it, is here I am on a podcast.
Get some new opportunities.
Exactly. And I think that's a great note to sort of end on, because we want to thank you all, our listeners, for being part of our social networks as well. I think technology has allowed us, the amazing when I think back about what reality was like in my childhood versus now, just being connected to all of you and getting some of those comments, really keep those coming, because those really feed us in fun ways as well. And we love to hear, even if you just listen to us on your way to work and want to tell us that, we love to hear that too. So that definitely feeds us, and we love that you allow us to be a little part of your professional social network and your professional friends as well. So as always, I want to thank Jerry and Kurt. Great episode. Happy Memorial Day, and again, thanks for all those who serve our country and serve those who serve our country. As always, you can find show notes, links, discussion questions, videos, and more at traumainformedlens.org. And Kurt and Jerry, thank you. And Jerry, you know, maybe par today? I don't know. Maybe it's a good day for that. So
best wishes for a good round.
At least one now will bring me back. That's all.
There you go. You guys have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Okay. Thanks, guys.